Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, we resume our Races to Watch series ahead of November's general election in the state Senate's 6th district. We also learn more about the rising influence of political action committees in Delaware elections from DSU political science professor Sam Hoff.
The rise of these political action committees is concurrent with single-issue campaigns across the United States.
I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Arts Playlist puts a spotlight on Jazz Age illustrations now on display at the Delaware Art Museum. And Enlighten Me explores mosquito-borne illnesses showing up in the first date and how to protect yourself. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first date of mine. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As part of our 2024 election coverage, Delaware Public Media is highlighting a series of races to watch. The first race we're looking at ahead of November's general election is in Sussex County. The 6th District State Senate seat is one of only two contested state Senate seats in this general election, and the only one where a Democrat and a Republican square off. Incumbent Democrat Russ Huxtable seeks another term against his Republican challenger, Kim Hoey Stevenson. And Delaware Public Media contributor Paul Kiefer reports the race has featured a largely civil tone between the two candidates.
Delaware is the fastest-growing state in the Mid-Atlantic region, and the 6th Senate District is at the center of that population boom. The resulting pressures on fragile coastal ecosystems, farmers, road and sewer infrastructure, the local healthcare system and housing supply, and looming above it all, the regular threat of flooding, are front of mind for district residents. And both Huxtable and Stevenson know it.
The issues are overdevelopment, roads, medical, you know, can we get doctors? Those are the questions that people, those are the same things that come up over and over again.
Stevenson argues that the job of the 6th District Senator is principally to help coordinate between state agencies in Sussex County, as both attempt to balance development pressures with long-term planning.
Land use is the county's lane. The roads and school funding are, you know, mostly the state lane, but those two need to be intersecting.
That isn't a controversial goal. Huxtable says better managing development in the district is a bipartisan priority, and one that is as relevant to newcomers as it is to longtime residents.
It doesn't matter if they've just arrived here or if they've been here for a while. They have the same concern. I equate this to like a stove. Imagine you're cooking dinner on a 6-burner stove. I think they've got every single burner turned on high and something's burning and folks know it. And so I think there needs to be some knob turning and some better coordination between county and state.
The 6th District race isn't marred by personal attacks or predictable partisan bickering. The candidates have instead leaned largely on their resumes to draw support. For Huxtable, the most important highlight of his resume is a 2-year record in the General Assembly. He cites his leading role in convincing Delaware's Department of Education to allow school districts like Cape Henlopen to build new schools to fit projected growth in student populations rather than current student populations, as well as his work to expand Delaware's Affordable Housing Development Fund from $4 million to $31.5 million last year, the first expansion of the program's budget since 1987.
I think if I had not been elected, I don't think that would have been the case.
Stevenson points to her time on the Sussex County Planning Commission and as a communications director for Delaware Senate Republicans.
I mean, I'm the only candidate who has county and state experience. So I know who to call. And I do that now. People call me now.
That absence of partisan bluster is mostly to be expected in a relatively moderate district that first elected a Democrat, Huxtable, 2 years ago. Registered Democrats outnumber Republicans by roughly 8 percentage points in the district. But Democrats also held a registration advantage, albeit a smaller one, when former Republican Senator Ernie Lopez won the district in 2018. Neither party can claim a majority of the district's voters. Independent and unaffiliated voters are nearly as numerous as Republicans. Both candidates say some of the most recent efforts by Democratic state lawmakers to set new guardrails for development have been well received among 6th District voters, despite those rules placing some limits on the authority of local governments, often a red line in Delaware politics. This year, for instance, state lawmakers voted to require towns and counties to factor climate change into future comprehensive plans. Huxtable says voters' feedback on that requirement has been overwhelmingly positive. Stevenson takes no issues with the law, which she says is both in the interest of the district and redundant in Sussex County. The county began considering the impacts of climate change in its comprehensive plan as early as 2018.
You know, this was, you know, a legislation that to codify something we're already doing.
Indeed, Stevenson says her voting record on the county's planning commission reflected the need to take coastal flooding into account when approving new developments.
My last night on the planning commission, I presented the denial of a neighborhood called Stillwater that where they were going to build it, the entrance was going to be underwater several times a year.
Huxtable emphasizes the role of public transportation and the land use changes needed to make public transportation a viable option for more district residents as part of sustainable planning in Sussex County and as a cost-saving alternative for residents struggling with rising living expenses.
And if we can encourage less reliance on vehicles, that would be good for the working class. Because owning a vehicle is expensive.
The candidates also align on the subject of Delaware's open space and farmland preservation programs, which both argue are chronically underfunded, though they offer different suggestions for where the state might find dollars to redirect to the programs.
Right now, it's a flat $10 million a year for open space and ag land preservation put into that program from the realty transfer tax. I would prefer to see almost a percentage of those transfer taxes be put into open space and ag land preservation for kind of counterbalance the reason why we're getting those funds, because we are developing farmlands in open space.
Along similar lines, Huxtable pointed to a bill he sponsored this year that provided state matching dollars for crop insurance, a complement to the state's agricultural land preservation program intended to help keep farms profitable. Stevenson, on the other hand, suggests that the state should redirect a larger portion of its unclaimed property revenue, which accounted for just over 6% of Delaware's total revenue in 2023, to the preservation programs. She says that investment would offer a better alternative to the current use of that revenue to feed the state's general fund. She says that investment would offer a better alternative to the present use of that revenue, which currently feeds into the state's general fund.
When we get a windfall, let's put that aside so that we have that for these things.
Neither candidate is eager to engage in open partisanship, but despite their bipartisan messaging, they're also not running as independents. Indeed, Stevenson says she does not anticipate breaking with fellow Republicans on any key votes should she win in November, and she joined fellow Republicans in criticizing the Delaware Department of Natural Resources rule adopted last year requiring that 82% of new cars and trucks sent to Delaware be zero-emissions vehicles.
Whether you believe that electric vehicles are the future or not, and they might very well be, that law became law without a single legislator voting on it. That shouldn't happen.
Huxtable, in contrast, voted in favor of a bill requiring new single and multifamily housing to include electric vehicle charging infrastructure in 2023. Governor Carney signed that bill into law 4 months before DENREC finalized its zero-emissions vehicle rule. He says that on some fronts, including on sustainable development policy, the state may need to step in to prevent local politics from derailing key priorities.
And if the state needs to assist a local jurisdiction by being the bad guy, because to get the local legislator to be like, the state's making me do it. Like, then maybe we need to, you know, to do the right thing and not be afraid that we may lose an election because we did the right thing.
Despite some policy differences under the surface, the national political climate does not appear to have trickled down into the race for Delaware's 6th Senate District, and both candidates appear to prefer a resume contest over an ideological showdown. Paul Kiefer, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Paul. And stay with us. We're joined by a Delaware State University political science professor to discuss the increasing influence of political action committees in first state elections. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The 2024 presidential campaign is on track to be the most expensive election cycle in U.S. history, thanks in large part to the influence of political action committees, or PACs, independent groups that raise and spend money to elect and defeat candidates. PACs tend to represent specific interests or ideologies, and their finances come mainly from the wealthy, various corporations, or labor unions. And in Delaware, an increasing number of PACs are both taking part in and significantly impacting the state's political landscape. This week, Delaware Public Media's Common Canon spoke with Samuel Hoff, professor of history and political science at Delaware State University, about the growing influence of PACs and out-of-state money in Delaware politics.
Why are we seeing this rise in PACs in Delaware's, you know, politics, and how long has it been going on?
PACs have been around since the 70s legally, and in the last 18 months at the federal level, the number is more than 8,500 political action committees. Here in Delaware, there are at least 141 registered, according to the latest numbers. The reasons are multifaceted. One is that the federal law and the Supreme Court decision that augmented that back in 2010, along with state rules, are pretty beneficial to political action committees. For instance, there is no limit on the amount that political action committees within Delaware can contribute as long as they adhere to some other rules. So that's a beneficial setup for a lot of the political action committees. Then we have to look at the expense of campaigns. You know, the TV markets, particularly Philadelphia, very expensive, and other methods of campaigning that, you know, were traditional are being replaced by digital and others. And you always have campaign consultants. So you add that. It takes a lot of funding to really fund a campaign. And it's hard for individuals often to do that on their own. They're trying to get funding from political parties, from individuals, and as I say, since the 70s, legally from political action committees. In Delaware, I think the number of political action committees has spiked because the number of candidates in particular within this particular election season, particularly our gubernatorial, where we had three on both sides of the nomination process, a Democrat and Republican, seen political action committees established as a essentially some link to a candidate, whether for personal or professional reasons. We've also seen some political action committees support candidates because of their positions on policy. And that seems to be one of the things that we've, patterns that we've uncovered. And finally, I think that the rise of these political action committees is concurrent with single issue campaigns across the United States. And when we talk about that, we're talking about very controversial issues such as abortion or gun rights, obviously immigration at this time, and crime. Crime prevention are the topics that are often supported by political action committees in a singular issue type campaign.
For Delaware specifically then, Sam, as opposed to maybe other states or regions of the country, why is the increase in PACs uniquely or significantly problematic here? Is there something about Delaware and this rise in the influence of PACs that affects the state in any unique way or its landscape?
Well, that's a very good question. And I believe that we have to think in broad terms today. We used to look at Wilmington as a sort of broad part of a metropolitan Philadelphia area, but we blocked the other two counties. Now we have to think about the entire state as part of that metropolitan area. And as I say, that specifically on issues of spending, where you got to get those funds in to reach folks in the out-of-state market, political action committees have filled the void that other folks would not be able to do in terms of that type of funding. So I really think that that's unique, and I don't think that it would be wise for political consultants or candidates to think any more in pure border terms to stop, you know, trying to campaign and do so with the idea that there's going to be influence on the other side of the border, because there is, and we've seen it, and that influence is more and more. And it's concurrent with increase in population and changing demographic patterns that are important as we move on and look at Delaware's political element.
maybe if you're able to just speak to this even anecdotally, what are you seeing in terms of PAC involvement this election season here in Delaware? Are we even able to assess that?
Well, yeah, we've seen political action committees. As I said, there was one particular for Bethany Hall Long that supported her in her gubernatorial bid within the Democratic Party. And it was actually related to a position, a national position she had for the Lieutenant Governors Association. And that's just one example of how an affiliation with a group can turn around to assist you in a campaign, legally, in the sense that political action committee obviously formed and then contributed. So in that sense, I found it interesting because it's not a single issue and it's not a policy issue, what I call it. It's more of a personal affiliation for the reason that that political action committee contributed. You know, that brings up what PACs want to do in campaigns, and that is influence the direction in their way. And when we look at the federal PACs, we can see that, as I mentioned, over 8,500, they took in $7 billion and spent $6 billion over the last 18 months. Again, I say billion. That's PACs at the federal level dealing with the president, the House, and the Senate. So that gives you an idea of what their level they're at and what an influence they can have. Does money buy votes? I'll leave that for your listeners.
Well, how you touched on this, but how is all this in terms of who regulates PACs and campaign finances in our politics, that's essentially non-existent? Can you walk us through that?
No, within the state, there are certain rules for PACs cannot contribute to parties, and there are other basic ideas for regulating, but the amount, as long as they're properly registered, is the big allowance in the state at this particular point. As I said, the last look, there were about over 140. But one of the specific rules is that you can't specifically say we're supporting a candidate. And in that sense, you have to make your commercials creative. And you can tell them to support legislation. You can thank them for supporting legislation, thank them for their constituent service. And obviously, those are types of positive oriented commercials. But that's an important way to think about political action committees.
Yeah. And when we say, for those that don't know, when we say, you hear that term super PAC a lot, especially these days in recent years. What does that mean exactly? Is it just PACs on steroids, essentially, when it comes to finances and involvement? What does that mean?
PACs can be created in several types of organizations, labor, trade organizations. The largest type of PAC today is one that is called non-connected. So when you get a series of PACs, usually in the same broad area, grouping together, we call that a super PAC. Now, the federal government has scrutinized that, in the sense that they have previously ruled against what is called bundling, but that's loosened up since the 2010 Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court. And so you have those types of organizations getting together in the same context, in the same campaign.
Speaking in broad strokes here, I've read about concerns that democracy is going to lose its legitimacy if we don't do something about, you know, campaign finance reform and perhaps deregulate it in some fashion and somehow maybe put a cap on campaign contributions. I think that kind of plays a little bit hand in hand here with our discussion over PACs. But what do you make around that concept of campaign finance reform and potential deregulation in the context of political action committee involvement?
I think I'd comment on your broader question, which is, you know, what PACs might be doing to the political system in the sense of the person with the most money might win. And that certainly isn't always the case. I did a study of presidential primary PACs back in the 70s and 80s and found the person with the most efficient spending one. And that was not always the person who got the most money. And so that's a big difference. But what I worry about, sir, is the diminution of trust in the political system for that, or a growing cynicism for that very reason. And how can we diminish that? Well, you had a point, I think, in referring to campaign finance to try to even things out, or you can find other ways. But what is kind of disappointing is to see some candidates who do a great job at being able to get small donations from contributors and supporters. And that does speak to representative democracy. But, you know, it's when we come in with these single large type contributions that things can go significantly off balance. So I think there are other ways to deal with it, both radical and subtle, but we need to keep an eye on that.
I want to finish with the role of the voter here, though, Sam. How much responsibility do we put on the voter here to do their research so they have the ability to sort through all of this and essentially repel the influence of PACs and their skewed messaging? Or obviously it's favorable in that sense, but you know, how much responsibility do we put on the voter here?
Our listeners as voters are going to express themselves through either supporting a candidate or opposing one, and we let them make that choice, you know, in their heart in terms of doing it. PACs, in that sense, are a legitimate part of the American political system, but ultimately we have to always think of the individual as doing that. And so, I mean, it's pretty easy to go on the Federal Election Commission website, and even easier to go on a Delaware election office site to be able to garner some of the statistics that I referred to here.
Thanks to Samuel Ha, professor of history and political science at Delaware State University, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us this week on The Green. And stay with us. The Green continues with Arts Playlist, where we learn about the new Delaware Art Museum exhibition focused on the Jazz Age. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Delaware Art Museum's new exhibition showcases the Jazz Age of the early 20th century. Jazz Age Illustration is the first major exhibition to highlight the era's popular illustrative work and includes special programming and events around it, like jazz concerts and an era-themed gala. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sits down with curator Heather Campbell Coyle at the Delaware Art Museum for a firsthand look at Jazz Age Illustration.
Heather, we're sitting here at the Delaware Art Museum, which has just rolled out its latest exhibit, Jazz Age Illustration. It's essentially a one-of-one, and I feel pretty confident in saying that, having just walked through it with you. It's the first major exhibit of its kind, so if you could walk our listeners through the exhibit now and what exactly we're showcasing here.
Absolutely. So Jazz Age Illustration is a project based in the Delaware Art Museum's collection. About 80% of the work, which is almost 200 things, comes from the museum and library collections here. We've been working on the project, along with a lot of other things, but we've been working on the project for about 5 years, building it to tell a broad story of American illustration between 1919 and 1942, the so-called Jazz Age.
Okay, yeah, so this is indeed illustrative work based in the early 20th century, and I encourage our listeners to visit our site, the Delaware Art Museum's site, and to visit the museum to see the exhibit, most importantly. But two things here. Why showcase this era's artwork specifically, and how would you describe then what's featured in Jazz Age Illustration in terms of, you know, things like general style, color palettes, and so on?
Okay, so at the Delaware Art Museum, we were founded with American illustration, with the work of Howard Pyle. We are always showing illustration, but we're showing a particular story of illustration, which is largely Howard Pyle and his students' work from the late 19th and early 20th century. So work up through the 20s, but if a somewhat narrow scope of it. The idea with Jazz Age Illustration was to take some of the enormous amount of material that is in our collection that doesn't get shown every day, much of which is work on paper, and work in different styles, and work we've collected recently, particularly work by women and artists of color. So trying to broaden the story that we tell of American illustration in this big exhibition.
So for you personally, then, what are some of your favorites in the exhibit, or maybe some that you think visitors will really take to?
So as a young woman, as a girl even, I loved the 1920s, and I loved Art Deco and 1920s style. And I think those are things that are really well represented, that are kind of fun and surprising for us as the Delaware Art Museum to be featuring. So some of the Art Deco posters, the work of John Held Jr., who was a big deal in this period. He worked mostly in black and white and kind of minimalist, but he didn't just do illustrations for books and magazines, though he did lots of those. He also illustrated barware and designed textiles and posters and brochures, so many things. So it's great to see his work across many media. And perhaps importantly for the story of this exhibition, he illustrated the cover of Tales of the Jazz Age by F. Scott Fitzgerald, which is kind of how the period gets its name.
Well, you might have mentioned this just now, but I know you said when we were walking through the exhibit that there are, 126 pieces that make up this exhibit? And then there's, you know, dozens of publications and physical objects and whatnot that make up Jazz Age Illustration. Do I have that right?
Yes, there's 126 works on the walls and 69 in cases. It's an enormous exhibition for us. We borrowed from 15 different private collectors and other institutions, especially to help us tell stories that we can't tell as well as we'd like to yet. In particular, we borrowed a lot of work to represent the Harlem Renaissance, which was such an important part of what visual culture of the early of the 1920s and 30s was.
And as you also mentioned earlier, then, this exhibit kicks off the museum's Year of the Illustrator, which comes with a true bevy of events and special programming. So can you tell us more about that and what's all a part of this Year of the Illustrator?
Sure. So the Year of the Illustrator is a celebration of the new narratives we are telling around illustration. Illustration as a more diverse medium, and illustrators as a more diverse group of practitioners. So we will be having a Jazz Age gala. We are having where people can come in costume, should they choose to, or in outfits inspired by the 1920s and 30s. We are having gallery talks, and of course we are having a jazz series. Jazz is an ongoing art form, so many current jazz players coming here to present as well. And we are hosting a symposium where people who really want to learn deeply about the Jazz Age from academics can hear some of the latest research. Our show, The Jazz Age, is really only a slice of the scholarship that's being done and a slice of the artists. So I'm so excited for the symposium to present even more perspectives on what's happening.
And all the dates and the times for everything going on with Year of the Illustrator is on the Delaware Art Museum's website. But there's a lot going on here, Heather. You told me earlier when we were walking through the exhibit that Jazz Age Illustration was originally supposed to happen in 2021. This is essentially 5 years in the making. How much goes into planning something like this?
It does take years to plan a major museum exhibition. 2 years, like 18 months is quick. 2 to 5 years is not unusual at all. You have to identify, you've got to do the research to figure out what you want on the walls. You have to identify where it is. And then you have to ask to borrow things often. And even works from your own collection might need conservation. We had a big grant to do conservation. We conserved 41 things for this exhibition, just work that hadn't been shown that needed some care.
Well, what are some of those bigger challenges in putting all this together? Is it like logistics stuff or making sure everything has the same through line? Is it playing a game of whack-a-mole in terms of putting out fires and just getting to the finish line? Can you give us an idea of some of those bigger challenges?
When you create an exhibition or program from the ground up, it always has more complicating factors. Our registrars are the ones who kind of keep us on schedule on everything and keep us and make sure all the art gets here safely. They do a lot of work with contracts for this, getting and also with monitoring all of the conservation work that needs to be done on works from the collection. So those things are all long lead things. We asked for the first loans for this show over 2 years ago, knowing that we might not be the only people asking for some of these works, particularly as we knew we were going to be in the 2020s, we wouldn't be the only people looking to celebrate the 1920s. So we asked for the wonderful works from the National Portrait Gallery very early, knowing that there were some other Harlem projects happening.
Right. And there's just so much to this Jazz Age illustration exhibit and how it works hand in hand with Year of the Illustrator. But from your view, what do you hope people take away from the exhibit and all the programming and the events that come along with it?
I think that just the incredible range of images and illustrators. There's so many styles in that room. There's so many illustrators with different backgrounds and different stories. I want people to see what a diverse time it is. Illustration isn't one story. It's kind of the story of all of us, particularly in that period when illustration was such an important way of representing what was happening and, of course, also what people were aspiring to.
Mm-hmm. So what's something about this exhibit then that might surprise people? Maybe I'm thinking the illustration, the thought processes, the evolution of how women are viewed at the time is really interesting. What's something that you think might surprise some folks?
So we certainly have some classic flapper images, which I think people expect when they think of the 1920s, although they might not look exactly like we think of flappers looking now in a costumey sense. But just how new those roles were and how nervous the changes around women's lives made people in this period. It tended to end with a lot of images of the women and the stories behind them. The women were presented either as good girls who dressed in modern clothes, or they were these flapper types. These wild young women were reformed by meeting the right man and marrying them. Occasionally, they got to stay bad girls, but they were, of course, punished for those sins. So those flapper stories, I think, are one of the really interesting ones for people. And it was an absolute obsession of the period. Our librarian, Rachel Deleterio, has also created an entire illustration show based on flappers in books, sheet music, and magazines upstairs from our library collection.
Yeah, and I think there's also this really nuanced and really interesting push and pull that's going on with some of the pieces in this exhibit where Black men are not featured in illustrations, let alone magazines at the time, but when they are, they're seen in their societal or placed in their societal roles. There's this one piece where a Black man is essentially, he's on the cover of a magazine alongside a woman, but he is not her peer. He is her assistant of sorts. He's carrying all her bags. And so while he's featured prominently, he is still placed in his societal role at the time or of the time. There's another piece where a woman is in the setting of the onset of World War II. And so, you know, women are working in these, you know, non-traditional roles that women wouldn't have normally found themselves in, at least at the time. And so she's dressed like a man. She's eating out of a lunchbox. She's got a sandwich in her hand, you know, the whole nine. But she's reading a fashion magazine. So that's an interesting dichotomy, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that one of the really interesting things about the show is how much it has to tell you about the history of the period. So you see incredible illustrations by artists, by Black artists, by white artists, but you don't see much mixed, as you said. The policy, sort of the de facto policy of many magazines, was not to include Black and white figures together, or when they included African-American figures, that they would always be in positions of service. This is really typical in the Saturday Evening Post, but also in many other mainstream magazines. So artists were representing them in, you know, telling stories in particular ways, which is one of the reasons that the Black press needed to evolve, you know, to create their own stories and stories speaking to African-American audiences through the visuals of African-American artists.
Yeah, this exhibit really checks all the boxes. It's an immersive experience. It has, you know, physical objects, a diversity of artwork included, and illustrations. The music, there's jazzy music as you walk through it. It really is expansive. Like I said, it's immersive. But what does the timeline look like for all this? You know, the exhibit, Year of the Illustrator. What's the timeline for this?
So Jazz Age Illustration runs through January 26th, but that's still the beginnings of the Year of the Illustrator. There'll be programming throughout the show, but also programming throughout the year leading until next October, when we will host a traveling exhibition organized by the Norman Rockwell Museum called Imprinted, Illustrating Race. It is looking at representations of African Americans in the popular press from the 18th through the 21st centuries, including many illustrations by African-American artists, sort of reclaiming those visions in the 20th century.
Thanks to Delaware Art Museum curator Heather Campbell Coyle and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on this latest edition of Arts Playlist. You can check out Jazz Age Illustration at the Delaware Art Museum now through January 26, 2025. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we learn about mosquito-borne illnesses that are popping up in the first eight and how to protect yourself from them. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware's Division of Public Health and Department of Agriculture recently reported the first human West Nile virus case in the state this year. It comes amid concerns about a potential nationwide outbreak of another deadly mosquito-borne disease, Eastern Equine Encephalitis, or Triple E. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry catches up with the Division of Public Health's vector-borne disease epidemiologist, Antonio Alvarado, to learn more about West Nile virus, Triple E, and how to protect yourself.
Tony, let's start with the basics. I'm sure our listeners know about it, but what exactly is West Nile virus?
Sure. So West Nile virus is a mosquito-borne virus that can cause West Nile virus neuroinvasive or non-neuroinvasive disease. Mosquitoes become infected when they feed on birds that are infected with the virus, and then sometimes they'll just go off and bite a human or a horse, and it can cause some disease in humans or horses.
And what about Eastern Equine Encephalitis, or EEE? How's that defined?
Similar to West Nile, it is another mosquito-borne disease spread by mosquitoes. It's in a different family than West Nile virus, but symptoms are similar to West Nile, but Triple E is sort of known to be a little bit more severe. It has a case fatality rate of above 30%.
So then what's the distinction between West Nile, EEE, and Lyme disease?
And Lyme disease? So both Triple E and West Nile virus are mosquito-borne diseases, but Lyme disease is a tick-borne disease. And West Nile and Triple E are caused by viruses spread by mosquitoes, but Lyme disease is spread by ticks, and it's a bacteria. So very different in both the vector that spreads the disease and then the type of agent that causes the disease.
Well, now we know a case of West Nile was recently reported in Delaware. How common are West Nile and Triple E in this region? They're both fairly rare, right?
Yeah, they're fairly rare in the human population. It's endemic here in the United States since, I believe, 1999. So we see cases every year. We don't see a lot of cases here in Delaware, but last year we saw four cases. This year so far, we're up to two cases. So it is fairly rare, but, you know, we like to stay on top of things here at the Delaware Division of Public Health. So when those get reported to us, we like to follow up with an investigation and report any findings that we can to Denrec's mosquito control section.
Now, is there anything about Delaware and its general makeup and its climate and geography that makes it more or less susceptible to West Nile and Triple E? How much are we at risk of these here in the first state?
Yeah, so Delaware, as you might know, is filled with a lot of water. A lot of areas here in Delaware are below sea level, and there are a lot of, you know, retention ponds and stormwater basins that might hold water. We have some swamps here. We have the coastal saltwater marshes, which can breed a lot of mosquitoes. So we certainly see a lot of mosquitoes here in Delaware, and mosquito control is super important for our residents. There's nothing about Delaware that particularly makes it more or so, I guess, affected by West Nile virus, but we do see a lot of mosquitoes here.
Zooming out in terms of climate, where do these kinds of diseases thrive?
It depends. So these mosquitoes are insects. They're arthropods. They're cold-blooded. They rely on hot temperatures and humid environments to thrive. They need water. So mosquitoes only need a bottle cap of water to lay their eggs and for the larvae to hatch and grow. So if we have sort of warmer climates, you're going to see more mosquito populations. Sometimes there comes a point where it's just too hot and mosquitoes don't like that, but there is that sort of ideal humidity and temperature that the mosquitoes thrive on. So certainly as the climate warms and we're seeing more and more rainfall, looking at the hurricane that's hitting Florida right now, you know, a lot of times after these hurricanes, maybe a couple few weeks after that, you're left with a lot of water, that's standing water that's everywhere. And so you'll see sort of mosquito blooms in certain areas.
Okay, now let's say we've contracted one of these diseases. How do they affect us personally and our health? And what are the signs or symptoms to look for once you've gotten a vector-borne disease like West Nile and Triple E?
It's important to note that most people will not actually become sick. So there's a lot of people that are bitten by infected mosquitoes that won't actually develop a disease. In the case of West Nile virus, about 80% of people who become infected with the virus don't actually show any symptoms. Triple E is more rare, but can be more severe in its symptoms. And so of the people that do show symptoms, it's usually you'll have mild illness like a fever, headache, muscle aches, nausea, and it can actually lead to serious illness like severe headache, neck stiffness, mental confusion, seizures, coma, those sort of things. So when it leads to that, that's sort of a neuroinvasive presentation. So it can be severe. And in the case of Triple E, I had mentioned earlier that it's a 30% case fatality rate. So a third of people who do contract Triple E can end up actually dying from the disease. And if you are able to survive it, a lot of the times you're left with debilitating state afterwards.
Now, who's at the greatest risk of contracting a vector-borne disease? And is there a certain kind of person that's more vulnerable?
Yeah. In the case of West Nile and Triple E, the elderly population, so above usually 55 or 65, that population is usually susceptible to severe disease. And then certainly the population who are immunocompromised due to, you know, whatever reason, they also have a lower immune system, so they'll also be at greater risk.
Let's talk prevention. What does that look like, and what should or can we do?
Yes, this is the most important topic. So because there's no treatment for Triple E or West Nile virus, the best way to prevent the disease is to prevent mosquito bites. And the first step, there's multiple steps into doing that. The first step would be to look around your house to see if there's any standing water that you can dump. And that can be in a range of different items. So like someone has a wheelbarrow that's holding water, dump that. If someone has a tarp that's covering a boat that has some depressions that's holding rainwater, that's a mosquito habitat. Try to get that out of there as soon as possible. If you have rain gutters and it's clogged, it might hold water. And so we always recommend getting your gutters cleaned. And then also emptying your bird bath or changing the water in your bird bath sort of every week is a good thing to do, so it's not breeding mosquitoes. And then once you sort of have got that under control, you have no mosquito breeding grounds in your immediate vicinity, we do recommend using insect repellents when you go out. And particularly, you want to use EPA registered insect repellents. And so a lot of those organic or natural insect repellents, they don't last as long as these EPA registered repellents. And they also aren't tested by the EPA about their effectiveness. So we do recommend using those EPA registered insect repellents and then following the instructions for those repellents. And lastly, if you can, you can wear long sleeves and long pants if you go out. Some mosquitoes, particularly the Sarafera species, they have a painful bite and they can actually bite through some of the clothing. So it's not always effective, but, and especially people don't necessarily want to wear long sleeves in the heat of the summer. So there's that. And then if you can, avoid going outside during peak biting times. So that's dawn and dusk. And also another thing that just I always like to mention is using, if you're outside, sitting outside, use a fan, like a fan that's blowing air. Because mosquitoes are weak flyers, so they don't really want to fly upstream and put all that energy to bite you if there's this wind current. So if you can, use a fan outside.
That fan thing, that's a new one. I haven't heard that one yet. That's good. Thank you. Now, you touched on this a bit earlier, but if we contract it, what then? Do we go to the hospital? And what does treatment look like?
If you are developing symptoms after a mosquito bite, definitely go to a hospital. They can test you. You know, we aren't here at the Division of Public Health. We won't know that you have this disease unless you get tested for it. It won't get reported to us. So definitely go to a hospital, get tested for it. Sometimes they can provide you with supportive care. And if it develops into a severe neuroinvasive disease, they can certainly provide you with some supportive care, but not much you can really do once the symptoms do develop, because there's no treatment really for it. So going on to like the mosquito-borne diseases like dengue virus, which is all about on the news right now, you definitely want to, or malaria, you definitely want to avoid mosquito bites from local mosquitoes. So in the case of malaria, let's say you travel to a country, you contract it there, bring it back to the United States. We do have the malaria vectors here in the United States, in Delaware. So you want to avoid mosquito bites for a certain number of days after you return from somewhere overseas, just so you're not spreading that parasite or virus to local mosquitoes. But West Nile, you don't have to worry about that with West Nile and Tripoli, because humans don't create enough virus in our blood to reinfect mosquitoes.
Now, as far as all this goes, is there anything we should keep an eye out for as we head further here into the fall season?
As climate warms, the mosquito season might actually lengthen a little bit. So mosquitoes are active, you know, as soon as spring hits and you get that first temperature above freezing, some mosquitoes can be active, and they're active until the first consistent frost that we get at night. So that can be, you know, I was out walking my dog 2 days ago, and it was a little chilly at night, but I was getting swarmed by mosquitoes. Just, you know, I mean, I would continue practicing mosquito prevention until it gets cold. You know, try to prevent mosquito bites as best as possible.
Thanks to the Delaware Division of Public Health's vector-borne disease epidemiologist Antonio Alvarado and our Joe Irizarry for enlightening us this week. And we've reached the finish line for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor Paul Kiefer, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.